when you think about how change happens in the field of HR, that pace is really accelerating. And for listeners that have been in this space for 5 years, you'll know that it's a very different landscape than it was when you first got in. Now imagine looking at that over 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, how about 40 years? Today's guest is Bruce Morton. He is the head of strategy for Allegis Global Solutions, and he has been doing this. He's been working in this space for 40 years, so he has seen massive shifts in the industry. And we're going to talk more about really what he's seen, more importantly, kind of how he can leverage that past experience to get a gauge on what's coming next and what trends we need to be looking for. So really excited to dig into that conversation with Bruce after a quick word from our sponsor. 21st Century HR is a podcast exploring how to build better businesses through modern people practices and approaches. It's brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services that help companies build better organizations. From employer brand development and execution to global talent strategies, Amplify develops custom solutions that help clients from Hootsuite to SpaceX optimize their recruiting capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem was designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com. Hey everyone, welcome to 21st Century HR Podcast. I'm your host, Lars Schmidt. And today I am thrilled to be joined by the head of strategy for Allegis Global Solutions, Bruce Morton. Bruce and I are going to go into a range of topics spanning his over two decades in the field and really digging into some aspects of new phrases and frames around work, such as things like a talent sumer and a work design architect, and really digging into a bit more of the RPO and MSP models and how those work. So, Bruce, thanks so much for coming on the show. If you don't mind, why don't you give the listeners a brief introduction on you?
Great. Thanks, Lars. Great to be speaking with you. Yeah, so Bruce Morton, you'll guess from my accent, originally from the UK, now living in Connecticut. I've been here 10 years, and this is my 40th year. For my sins in this wonderful industry, and looking forward to conversation today.
Yeah, so Bruce, four decades in the field, you've seen a lot over that time. You've seen much of how you've probably seen a few complete, you know, different iterations of what the field even looks like. So from when you look back over your career and even to now, what ultimately has kept you in the field this whole time?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think simply because the industry changes so rapidly every 2 or 3 years. You know, I find myself constantly saying there's been more change in the last 12 months than the last decade. And that continues to be true. And I think like any job, you know, if you get bored of it, you want to move on. What I've been very lucky and very fortunate with the organizations I've worked around the world is if every day is a new challenge. Every day there's a different way to help solving our clients' challenges of attracting and retaining great talent. So, you know, in my mind, I guess I'm biased, but I think it's the best industry in the world.
Yeah, and so looking back kind of over the experience you've had over the last couple of decades, I think really in particular kind of looking at the industry in the 90s compared to how it is today, like what are some of the biggest differences? You kind of mentioned how every couple of years the industry goes through a new, you know, evolution and the practices, the technology, right. The expectations are very different. If what are some of the biggest kind of, you know, radical differences from HR in the 90s to HR today?
Yeah, I think from an HR perspective, I think organizations have finally realized that it's not just about the ability to attract great talent that it gives you a competitive advantage. It's what you do with that talent. And that might sound very obvious, but if you look back over the, you know, the last decades, it used to be about, you know, an organization's differential used to be the product they had, the service they were providing. Well, a lot of that's been flattened out because of the advent of technology, the internet, and everything else. So now, as we think about it, the new competitive advantage is organizational readiness enabled by talent. So I think from an HR perspective, they are far more, or in my mind, should be far more concerned with workforce design than ever before. How are you treating your individuals that work for you, whether they be an employee or a contractor? How are you giving them a phenomenal consumer-like experience? And how are you designing the way the organization gets work done to take advantage of this new worker? You know, back in the day, that you'd have a model where you'd hire somebody and then you'd look at a return on investment trajectory over the first 2 to 3 years. Well, we're not in that world anymore. How do you set yourself up so from day one that individual can start adding value, giving them support and infrastructure around them to succeed? To my mind, that's the fundamental biggest difference is the focus on workforce design.
Yeah, and I think that that's an interesting point because I think the very nature of what it means to be a worker, to be an employee, to be a contributor is shifted. And obviously in the 90s, there's no such thing as the gig economy. It's certainly right. Not at the scale that it is today. And I think the average tenure in the Valley right now is 2 years. The idea of having a 3 to 4 year plan for an employee is just not realistic in that environment. So how do you kind of add velocity to onboarding and impact? I think those kind of questions become really important. Your role, you have a really interesting vantage point, I think, because of where you sit in a company like Allegis Global Solutions. So, you obviously have a view across a variety of global organizations backed by data across those organizations that most kind of corporate practitioners wouldn't have. And so for listeners who aren't that familiar with kind of the RPO and MSP models, how would you break down, what those are and kind of how Allegis's business operates?
Yeah, I think so we're in the business of helping organizations get work done. And that is that phrase itself is a fundamental shift from a few years ago when our tagline was rethinking the way organization attracts and acquires talent. So we're still in the talent business, but our emphasis now and the way we think about how we add value to our clients is more around truly understanding the best way to get work done and then obviously be the provider of the talent to do that. So on the RPO side, that's about how do you attract potential employees, how do you get them on board, and how do you help them with retention? And on the MSP side of the house, that is all about the external or non-employee workforce. And anything you are getting done with a non-employee, whether you're using a contractor, a temp, or a professional services provider, giving visibility and managing the supply chain for all of that. So all in all, it obviously encompasses the total workforce, but we see it that way as employees versus external workforce.
Got it. And so with that, your view, I think, around talent is largely informed by the scope and breadth of Allegis's global portfolio. So what does that look like in terms of kind of industries, company sizes, and locations that are represented within Allegis?
Yeah, so we have on the MSP side of the house, we have over 100 clients. It's RPOs about 130. If you look at the mix, just over a third of those would be truly global. Then another third would be multi-regional or multi-country. And then the rest would be, country specific. And that's the whole gambit from, we have a specific offering for the medium-sized enterprises, which we call Sigma. And from a, contingent spend perspective to help the listeners gather, if that's anything between 5 and 50 million a year spend, anything above that is the enterprise MSP. So we look at it from, we have some organizations that are, got 100 contractors all the way up to global organizations who have many, hundreds of thousands of contingent workers. So it runs the whole gambit. And from an industry perspective, our strength some years ago was predominantly in the financial services and then IT, professional services, just because they were the organizations that bought into this concept first. But now it is incredibly diverse. If you look over the last 12 months, healthcare and energy would be the two biggest growth markets.
And when you look across the data and the metrics that you have across, I mean, that's a fairly massive portfolio side. I know you've kind of produced a lot of reports and data around trends that you're identifying within kind of your portfolio. Mm-hmm. So what would be, when you think about some of the trends that that stand out to you today based on what you're seeing in your portfolio, what are some of the trends that stand out to you? And then also, you know, are there any perhaps counterintuitive trends that you're coming across that you know, may cut against the grain of current wisdom?
Yeah, I think that so the biggest trend the last few years and is growing at a rapid pace is the world of services procurement, SOW, statement of work, professional services spend, call it what you will. So in that space, if you think about, you know, the world of MSP, 17, 18 years old, a lot of organizations got the visibility, compliance, risk management around their contingent workforce. But then what we saw and organizations started to see is while that spend is limited and sometimes shrinks, you see the spend pop up under statements of work. And that isn't necessarily people trying to hide it. It's just human nature. You've got to get work done. And if something becomes restrictive with tenure limits and so on, you're going to find the path of least resistance. So that concept of getting work done through a statement of work literally exploded 10 or so years ago. So the biggest trend we're seeing now is organizations realizing that to get full management of your external workforce, you can't just manage your contractors and your contingent workers. You have to get everything in the same place so you can start making some data-driven decisions based on how you're getting work done in different parts of the world. What is it truly costing? When should I be using a service provider under a statement of work, and when should I be using a contractor? And obviously, there's different legislation that is impacting that. You know, picky country, IR35 is an obvious one in the UK. So there's big, big changes there. Counterintuitive, I would say, in some parts of continental Europe, we're seeing governments reacting in a way that's trying to limit, in our mind, what the worker wants to do, how the worker wants to work. As you mentioned, the so-called gig economy, people are happy to be independent and stand on their merits and get paid for what they do. But governments, particularly in some continental European countries, are finding that hard because they, you know, they want their tax dollar, and that becomes more and more complicated when you've got these, you know, millions of people running around as independents as opposed to going to one organization for that check. So that seems to be, in my mind, that's counterintuitive to what the worker wants, and I think that will have to change over time. But we're still seeing some stubborn countries
that revenue. They want that revenue, so they're gonna try to find a way to claw onto that when they can. And I think that it's the shifting nature of really the worker and kind of what it means to work is that's always going to be ahead of the regulation, right? So I think as that continues to evolve, countries and entities will continue to try to figure out, like, how do they adapt to that? This is a new kind of construct around work itself, and it doesn't fall into traditional definitions. Absolutely. And with that, you know, you had coined a term that I found interesting of the talent-sumer. And so let's talk a bit more about that. What is a talent-sumer? How would you define that today?
Yeah, so, and this, some years ago when I first coined that term, it was a bit of a generational thing, but I'm past that now, and I think we're all talent consumers. In other words, we consume work and we act to behave as a consumer when we're in the workplace. So if you think about marketing 101, if you said, you know, what is the job of marketing in the consumer world, it's to get somebody's attention, turn it into attraction, turn them into a customer, give them great customer service and turn them into a brand ambassador. You know, Apple do a pretty good job of that in my mind. I'm a big Apple fan. So if you take that to the world of work and say, okay, how do I get somebody's attention, turn that into attraction, bring them into the organization, give them phenomenal customer service, they become a talent ambassador. And so what organizations are trying to get their head around is, how do I give those workers regardless of the contract I have with them, they're an employee, a contract, or whatever, how do I give them phenomenal customer service so that they become a talent ambassador? So it's making things easy. Sometimes it's just about getting out of their way. It's not making them sellotape receipts to a bigger piece of paper and fax them in and once a month for you to get your receipts paid through your expenses. All that stuff that we now have at our fingertips to make life easier that we all love in our consumer world. You know, you go out for a meal with your buddies and you press a button and you Venmo whatever and the bill's paid, it's split. How do we bring all that to give our employees and our workers a phenomenal consumer experience so they can just get work done and become far more efficient and effective? Now, that used to be about productivity. It was very corporate-centric. Some people deciding at a corporate level, let's create some processes that are easier to increase or improve the productivity of our people. That whole thing's been turned on its head now. And talent humans are the people that are saying, hey, if you don't make my life easy, if I can't do my very best work with you, I'm going to walk. So that's how we see talent humans.
Yeah, and so that's a great point in terms of just the fluidity of talent, right? And we've talked about, you know, people working in the gig economy, people working in project-based assignments, obviously full-time employees, mm-hmm. part-time employees, contract. You have so many different classifications and categories of talent that is helping your organization. And the reality, especially for top talent that's very good at what they do, they've got a lot of options. And they will always have a lot of options. Yep. And so if you're not creating an environment and adapting your programs to not just entice but retain them, you're going to be hemorrhaging talent. And so I'm curious from your perspective, you know, what can companies do to create environments that are more effective? I think we talk so much about attracting talent and you can get into an employer brand and lots of other things there, but particularly around retaining talent in this new kind of mindset of a talent consumer, how can companies ensure that they are, increasing their ability to retain talent consumers and just general kind of talent these days?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One, and this is my favorite question in the world that I've asked literally thousands and thousands of people over the years is, and I always set it up, say, hey, get your, whoever works for you, get them in a room, preferably with beer and pizza, get a relaxed atmosphere, then ask them this question. How easy do we make it for you to do great work? And then sit back and be appalled by it when they tell you how hard it is to do great work.
Right. You're doing company. Nothing to help me achieve that.
But yeah, that's why you need the beer and pizza. It's just such a powerful question. So that's number one. And truly, and then do something about it. And then the second is projectize the work. People, and this has always been the same, you know, I don't want to get into a generational thing, but more than ever now, people want to have short-term recognition for themselves as much as they're, you know, the boss giving the pat on the back. It's, how do I projectize the work I do? How do I make sure that I'm not just doing the same old? And of course, now we can automate a lot of that stuff through AI and RPA, et cetera. So there's no excuse. So how do we just give people really exciting work where there's a start, middle, end? You know, you want your people to go home on a Friday night when they have that first glass of wine or gin and tonic, be absolutely shattered, but in the good way. If you're worn out and tired and you haven't achieved anything, it just becomes very frustrating. And, you know, that's when you get people either leave or worse still, they stay, you know, the captives. Those are, you know, a couple of things that I think are conceptually very easy to get done. But sometimes organizations are frightened to ask the question.
You know, I think that transitions to another concept I know you've talked a lot about, which is, you know, work design architect. And so when you're thinking about this new world of work and more project-based, kind of drivers for employees, what is the role of a work design architect?
Yeah, and this is one of those that I'll go on record and either be very smug in the future or I'll never mention again. But my prediction is that, like data scientist was a couple of years ago, this will be the sexiest job on the planet in 2020. So work design architect is an individual or an army of people that truly understand the business objectives. What is it that we need to achieve as an organization in the next 12 months or 2 years? and say, okay, look at the work architecture and the talent architecture that you have today, and then how to and lay out that journey. So on a very practical level, so rather than a head of IT saying, oh, can you go and hire me 3 Java developers, 2 project managers, and a QA, say, okay, don't talk to me about the people, talk to me about the work. What is it you're trying to get done? And then let me, as the work design architect, use all of the knowledge and the data that we have based on empirical evidence of the best way to get that work done, where to put it in the world, how long it should take, how much it should cost. Sometimes that's taking an automation first approach. What can be automated? What's left now in that description? Should we use employees for that? Should we outsource an element of it? What pieces should we never outsource, and so on? So it's truly acting as I'd liken it to a quantity surveyor in the construction industry. If you give a quantity surveyor an architect's drawing of a house, they'll be able to tell you how many bricks to buy, how much cement, how much plaster, what order you do the jobs in, first fix, second fix, how long it should take, and how much it should cost based on that drawing. I think we're getting to a world where the work design architect can look at that piece of work and the description of work and come up with the same strategy. So that's, in a nutshell, what a work design architect is.
Yeah, it's interesting. And have you seen any examples of a role like that existing today?
I've seen small examples, but not at a enterprise level. Yep. A couple of our clients have now created workforce transformation functions that don't sit in HR procurement. You know, typically we think about RPO or that world of permanent hiring is with HR, and contingent workforce used to sit with procurement. But now we're seeing, you know, early days, but we're seeing new functions being popped up. And within those functions, they might not use that very phrase, but that's what they're doing. They're doing that work of triaging pieces of work to think about getting them done differently. And it's interesting, I think the new kid on the block, so to speak, is the CFO now, where the CFO gets involved in those conversations. We're seeing real momentum to think differently about how to get work done. Because the old days of going into the CFO and say, here's my strategic initiative for next year, and they look at the bottom right-hand corner of the spreadsheet and say, you know, try harder, go away and come back. Rather than just saying, cut costs, shave a bit here, well, hang on, do we have to get it done that way? Is there a different way of getting to that result?
Yeah.
So it's still early days, but I think incredibly exciting times for HR in particular that I, you know, have a real chance here to own that space.
Well, I think it speaks to the you know, kind of breaking the cycles of how workforce planning has always been done, right? And how, you know, again, your example, the spreadsheets, you know, you're typically looking at going into the beginning of the year, you've got a set of deliverables you as an organization and as a department you're going after. You think it's going to require X amount of headcount at Y projected cost, and it's very transactional, and it's really not, it's pretty rigid, I think, the way that a lot of companies, the legacy way of approaching how they're going to resource these projects. And so I'm curious to get your perspective. You know, how can companies begin to change that mindset and really future-proof their organizations around organizational readiness that's much more kind of adaptive and fluid and kind of takes into account all the different resources and kind of constructs of work at their disposal?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I opened a large global workforce planning conference a few years ago, and there were 400 people in the audience. And I said, how many people have achieved workforce planning? And 3 hands went up out of 400. So, okay, now I've depressed you. And I think the challenge was, because it was called workforce planning and strategic workforce planning, but it wasn't taking all the elements of work and talent into account. So I'm trying to explain what I mean by that. So I think the HR's function now, amongst all the million things they do, is to function by function, sit down with the head of that function and say, okay, let's break down how you're getting work done today. And if you can picture this on a big wall of saying, you know, using some sort of graph to say type of person, demographic, tenure, contract we have with them, the cost of it, country by country, and say, okay, so today that's how we're getting work done. Now talk to me about what great success looks like in the next 12 months. What are the big things you've got to achieve? So what does the team need to look like? What does the talent architecture need to look like to achieve that? So now you've got two different pictures. How do we move from A to B? To my mind, that is workforce design just as much as it is workforce planning. And it might sound simple, but by changing the word from plan to design, it changes the mindset. You know, and running design thinking workshops, have that mentality to think about getting work done, as opposed to, I think, where workforce planning came out of was far more statistical, doing some scenario planning, the what ifs, very, very number based around headcount and cost, as opposed to thinking it from a business perspective. There's a lot there, I know, Lars, but that's the way I think about that.
No, I think that does make sense. And I imagine, you know, all of that probably tied into your decision, you know, last year to release your book, you know, Redesigning the Way Work Works. And, you know, that there's a lot packed into that. And I'd love to, you know, kind of get all of the key takeaways for listeners, you know, from that. But we don't have that long of a show. So I'm curious, right, like, if you distill that down into, you know, the one or two kind of biggest fundamental shifts that you see happening in the way work works and how companies need to kind of redesign how they view that, what would those be?
I think, first of all, let me tell you why I wrote the book. I hit 60 and I've been in the industry 40 years, and it was almost a present to myself. I got all this stuff going on in my head, and I'm like, I've got to get it out there. And it was a bit of it is a soapbox. It's very much an opinion book. But I think what I want people to take away from that, and the editor I work with, she said, you know, what are the big things? So they're top of mind, is to help people change the conversation. And again, that perhaps that doesn't sound that fundamental or that mind-blowing, but I think it is a big thing. Change the conversation to talk about business objectives. Let your business objectives control or plan or design the way you think about getting work done. And that leads on to the second one, is always think work first, not talent. Think about the work, let the work design the type of talent you want. And then the last piece would be, hopefully people realize that job descriptions and people descriptions are of yesterday. And if you're still hiring based on a job description that was created 3 or 4 years ago, you're limiting and holding back the organization. People don't want to be stuck into those boxes anymore. So that's what I'm hoping people come out of that and just think, get them to think differently, inspire them to go to work regardless what position they're in, and just change the conversation.
Yeah. Well, I guess with that framing, you know, how would you define 21st century HR?
I think it's a genuine race to who's going to own this space right now. I think we've seen, if we look at our portfolio across our MSP clients, 50% of our stakeholders are procurement, 50% are HR. Let's say 10 years ago, it was like 95% procurement because they saw it as a supply chain purchase. So HR are getting into that world now, but we're definitely at a crossroads of who is ultimately going to own that space. And I think if HR can get the head around data and truly be the custodian of that data to make informed decisions. I'm not saying they have to be a winner, but if they had to be a winner, then I think they can win that race. So I think 21st century HR is thinking, and I'll keep using this phrase, of course, how is the organization getting work done today? How do we need to get work done in the future? What does the shape of the organization need to look like? They need to own that space and drive the strategy, as opposed to somebody else making those decisions and then passing it over the fence and say, go deliver on that, please. So hopefully that answers that question at a high level, at least.
Yeah. No, it does. And I think you raise an interesting point of just, I think, how the nature of HR has evolved, right? You know, legacy HR and kind of more personnel-oriented HR, it was very much the organization and the business dictating the strategy. Yep. And kind of handing it over and HR figuring out how they support it. You know, now, you know, the HR, the people leader, is a driving force in what that strategy should be and how it aligns to the organization. And I think that if you look at kind of modern chief people officers and the kind of the DNA of a modern CHRO, they're business operators. And they're focused on people, but they have the business acumen of a CFO, yep, of a CMO, of a CEO. They operate at that level. And so they're now designing people strategies that are really supportive and additive and aligned to the organizational strategy. And that I think is something that certainly you saw examples of in the past, but I don't think that discipline was as kind of broad and as wide reaching as it is today. And as it's kind of becoming more and more so as that role and ultimately the field continue to evolve.
Yeah, and I think it's a two-way street. It takes organizations to realize that, to hire the right people into those roles and give them the freedom to do that. So sometimes we hear this old HR been asking for a seat at the board table. You know, how many years have we heard that? And I think they've got it now, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you've still got to have the right sort of organization that truly gets that and truly understands it. And I think that's why data is so, so important, because you can't argue with it. It takes away the subjectivity. You know, we do that at a practical day-to-day when our folks are sat in front of a hiring manager and the hiring manager says, oh yeah, I want one of these skills. I want to pay this. I want them hired in 5 days. You know, without data, it becomes an argument. With data, it's like, no, let me tell you why you won't get somebody for that. Here's a supply and demand for that specific skill set in this zip code today. Let me tell you how long it's going to take to hire them. And by the way, if we pay X amount of dollars below the bill rate, the suggested bill rate, that person will leave within this number of days. That becomes a real powerful conversation with data. So I think that's where HR are at right now. You know, if I was a CHRO, I would be getting myself obsessed with data.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, I think 21st century HR, I mean, one of the key linchpins is, you know, the evolution from, data and reporting to analytics and insights, right? Yep. So it's, we have so much data at our disposal now. How do we synthesize it to really extract insights that can impact the business? And I think when you talk about, you know, influencers, seat at the table, when you've got that, right? You can kind of help the organization really understand, and kind of pull meaning from data in a way they just couldn't before. And that's a game changer.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Bruce, I really appreciate you coming on the show to share your experience and wisdom. I will include a link to the book Redesigning the Way Work Works in the show description. So if you're listening and you want to check that out, highly recommend that. And thanks so much for your time.
Fantastic. It's been great chatting to you. Thanks, Lars.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor and share it with your peers, your network, your boss, and your CEO. Help me get the podcast into the ears of anyone who wants to know what HR and recruiting looks like when done really well. They'll thank you for it, and so will I. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.